Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, March 10th, 2011. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. With this week, Berliner Weiss. Andy Sparks and Michael Tonsmeyer, the Mad Fermentationist, share some samples of this fun, sour German session beer and let us know how they brewed them. If you're new to home brewing or would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can find me on Twitter. I'm Basic Brewing. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james, and our show page on Facebook is at facebook.com/basicbrewing. Thanks to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. Whenever you think of Amazon, think of us and click on our associate link first. It won't cost you any extra, and you'll be helping us to bring you this show, and we greatly appreciate your support. We also have associate links for Brew Your Own Magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too. And if you have an iPhone or an Android phone, you can find our podcast apps on those respective stores. And BlackBerry users, we love you, too. You can find us on the BlackBerry podcast directory now as well. Let's take a look into the mailbag. Jacob from down in Louisiana has this note of interest. He says, I was wondering if you could plug an event for us again this year, the Red Stick Brewmasters. That's Red Stick, not Red Neck, like last year. Ha ha. In Baton Rouge, Louisiana, we'll be taking part in the Zaps International Beer Fest again. The event is on March 26th from 3:30 to 6 p.m. at the LSU Rural Life Museum. What's that, Tom Brokaw? The LSU Rural Life Museum. Thank you, sir. There will be plenty of beers available, including several award-winning beers from the club, like a Hazed and Confused Black IPA. Sounds fun. March 26th, 3:30 to 6 p.m. at the LSU Rural Life Museum. If you listened last week, you heard that we had a bunch of responses from brewers participating in the BYOBBR collaborative experiment, more than we have ever had on an experiment. We were looking at starch conversion testing with iodine and when that test actually shows negative for starch and what that means. Unfortunately, I was notified that two entries of data did not make it to me for some reason before the show. Richard Scipione from Oklahoma City, Oklahoma, brewed an American Pale Ale. His base malt was American two-row, and he stirred his mash. And Richard reports his iodine test was negative 25 minutes into the mash. And as I found out, Richard also reports that opening the mash tun and stirring every 5 minutes had a dramatic effect on the temperature of his mash. And as we talked about last week, stirring the mash and taking an iodine test reading every 5 minutes was useful for this experiment, but not advised for normal all-grain brewing. Thank goodness. Thanks, Richard, for that. I appreciate that. Our buddy Jeff Karpinski in Elizabeth, Colorado, submitted a second test of data for the experiment that somehow got lost in the ether. The second one was a Pilsner with German Pils as the base malt. The mash was recirculated. Jeff reports a clean iodine test at 25 minutes into the mash as well. He also says his pre-boil gravity target was reached at 45 minutes. And Jeff says, based on this data, I think I may be shaving 30 minutes off my mash times going forward. I am, however, curious if high adjunct beers would impact conversion time. Got a cream ale on deck, so some additional testing may be required. Let us know how that goes. Jeff continues, another important point here is that 15 to 25 minute conversion time means there's very little wiggle room for the brewer. Step mashes are going to be largely ineffective for conversion anyway, unless the brewer has the ability to alter mash temperature very rapidly. This also means there's little room for error in strike temps. If your desired mash temp were 150 and you overshoot it at 158, it may be quite difficult to correct before conversion is complete anyway. Interesting point. I appreciate Richard and Jeff for your patience. And Kelly Dodson who helps us on the website, will be trying another submission method next time to try to ensure that no data gets lost for the next experiment. I have forwarded the new data to Chris Colby so that that should be reflected in the BYO article. Here's a note from Scott in San Diego, where the National Homebrewers Conference will be held in June. Scott says, I'm one of the executives at the Target, a block away from where you will be staying, and I wanted your listeners to know that for those things that are kind of tough to get on a plane, there's a place a hop and a skip away to buy coolers, beach supplies, camping supplies, and we do sell beer, spirits, and wine. This should be the closest shopping location for anyone staying at the conference or any of the nearby hotels, and you can buy from a homebrewer that will be sadly be working rather than going to the conference. Well, doggone it, Scott. That'd be a shame if you're that close to if you were that close to the Homebrewers Conference and not being able to go, maybe you can get club night off at least. You should try that. Anyway, we may see you at your Target store to get our supplies and stuff. And by the way, while we're talking about San Diego, I have a challenge for those of you who are attending the National Homebrewers Conference in June. Steve, Andy, and I have our plans finalized to be there, and we want to challenge you to come up with an experiment for us to evaluate and put on the show while we're out there. If you remember a couple of years back, the Waha guys up in Seattle did a decoction experiment. And that turned out really interesting. And we'd like for you guys to do another one out there. Whether you're an individual that has an idea for an experiment that you want to try, or if you are a club who wants to do a collaborative experiment and share the results, we would love to talk to you. So drop me a line. James@basicbrewing.com, or just use the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and maybe we can get together. I think it'd be a lot of fun. Now let's get to the Berliner Weisse, which was a fun show to do. Andy and Mike have been chatting back and forth on the best way to brew this tasty, tart, little beauty. Michael Tonsmeyer, welcome back to Basic Brewing Radio.
Pleasure as always, James. What is this, 7 or 8 times I've been on now?
Is it? Who's counting? We've been together off and on, periodically for a long time now. I appreciate your continued friendship and support in helping us to learn more about more interesting beers. And that also extends to Andy Sparks, who's here in the studio. Welcome, Andy.
Oh, thanks for having me again.
Andy of thehomebrewery.com. Got me into brewing. It's all your fault that all this is happening. So
I'm sure everybody hates me for that.
We're here to talk about Berliner Weisses. And Andy, this started off with the discussion that we three had last year. Tell us about how this kind of evolved.
Right. Well, we've been on the show before, and one of the things that I enjoy talking to Michael about is his knowledge of sour beer styles. And I had been kind of a hankering for to brew up a session beer to go in between the bigger beers that I'm brewing. And I've tried a couple different things. And this one, Berliner Weisse, kind of appealed to me to be that kind of beer. So I contacted Michael, and we kind of started talking about the different ways you could go about making the style and a little bit about the history and stuff. So it's a fascinating beer style. It's pretty hard to find anymore. I know when we went to the JBF, we actually I made a point of trying to find this beer, and there was only one that we could find, and it was out by the time I got there. So, so it is kind of hard to find. So,
well, tell us about this beer, Mike, or the style.
The style. Yeah, Berliner Weisse. I mean, it's sort of one of those surprising things that when people think about sour beer, they think about Belgium, they think about lambics, Flanders Reds, Old Bruins. Even now, America, Russian River, Lost Abbey, New Belgium, all these great sour beer producers. Berliner Weisse is one of the only sour beer styles from Germany. It and Goes, and both are sort of these possibly died out at various points, possibly came back. probably have evolved since the time, you know, since their heyday, maybe 150 years ago. Berliner Weiss legally can only be brewed right around Berlin. There are a couple versions that are imported now that are brewed in other parts of Germany that they're not called Berliner Weisses. They'll say Berlin style Weiss or Weiss beer in the style of Berlin, something like that. Legally in Germany, they are very low gravity. They have to be between 1028 and 1032 starting gravity. Germany's very sort of precise on these gravities. It's a shank beer. It's a light beer. And so if you were higher or lower than that, again, it might be something else. It would still legally be beer, but it wouldn't be in the definition of a Berliner Weiss.
Berliner Weiss. So does this follow the Rheinheitsgebot?
It hopefully would if you brewed it to the German specifications.
Ah, okay.
Very simple recipe normally. Pilsner, wheat malt. So it would always be wheat malt because in Germany everything has to be malted. No raw wheat like you might use in a Belgian wit or something like that. And then a touch of hops and then both brewer's ale yeast, a clean strain, and lactobacillus. Would be sort of the primary ingredients in a standard version of a Berliner Weiss.
But there are different ways that you can, different paths that you can take to get to the end, right? I mean, there are, and you guys may have different methods in these two beers that we're going to taste tonight. Should we just crack yours open, Mike, and talk about where you started with this beer? And that way we can kind of wet our whistles at the same time we're learning something?
Sounds perfect.
Oh, wow. It's very light, very effervescent. It's got a nice white head on it.
Mm, nice and clear.
Cheers.
Mm. And between...
Oh, my.
Despite the low gravity, it should have a nice white head. It should have that carbonation. It's traditionally carbonated to 4 volumes of CO2, which is right at that level where if your bottles aren't in really great condition, they may explode. And so I'd highly suggest if you want to do the full traditional carbonation, you can get away with the regular, you know, brown long necks. But if you have some of those heavier German style half liter bottles or some Belgian 750s or something like that, that would certainly be the safer option.
Hmm. Wow. This is very tart. That'll pucker you up for sure. It's delicious.
It has a nice kind of creamy nose. The aroma off of it, maybe kind of like a lemon cream or a lemon chiffon or something.
Yeah. I get some sort of doughy, bready, yeasty sort of flavor to it. I mean, it's certainly not a malt forward beer, but there is some malt complexity there, I think.
Yeah. Now, what was the finishing gravity of this beer?
Pretty close to zero. It may be 0.01 or 0.02, something like that. But
But it's still probably because of the carbonation, it still has some mouthfeel. It still has a bit of body to it.
I think the wheat helps too. It gives it some protein structure. I think the sourness too, that latches onto your taste buds, and maybe that's what you're focusing on too when it's on your tongue.
Well, and this is one of the things that I really like about the styles that even though it's very very low in alcohol, it has a ton of flavor. You get the sourness, that kind of creaminess, the little lemoniness from the lactic acid.
And we should probably mention that what we're doing right now is something that no one in Germany ever does. Mm-hmm. Drink Berliner Weiss without Woodruff or raspberry or caraway schnapps or something else in it. My girlfriend was actually over in Berlin about 6 months ago, and despite having had Berliner Weiss before, knowing she liked my Berliner Weiss, wanted to try it in Berlin, despite having a German guide who spoke fluent German, they refused to give it to her without the syrup. Despite cajoling, they said, oh, you must want a Pilsner, you must want something else. No, I just want the Berliner Weiss without no syrup. And they said, no, well, that's not something we'll do.
Wow.
I think as Americans, it's funny, too, because in America, I think no matter what sort of request you make at a restaurant, if you really said that's really what I want, I think they'd bring you, chocolate sauce on your hamburger or, whatever crazy thing you might want. They might go, you're crazy, but here you go.
Right.
Now, when you have a Berliner Weiss over there, with syrup, do you regulate the amount of syrup in it, or does it come pre-sweetened?
I believe it comes pre-sweetened because I'm sure she, if they'd just given to her, you know, sauce on the side, you know, per se, that she would, you know, could have just left it off. But I believe it's that they're dosing for you.
Huh.
Well, you can buy those syrups at German specialty markets in America if you really want to try it. The first time I brewed one, I did buy them. The Woodruff sort of tastes like Lucky Charms to me. It has that sort of fake marshmallowy kind of flavor, and the raspberry is sort of a generic, you know, fake raspberry.
Yeah, we've tried both of those at your house, and I've tried the Woodruff at someone's house in Oklahoma who had brewed a Berliner Weiss as well. And to my palate, it kind of destroys the beer. It's kind of like putting barbecue sauce on well-smoked ribs with a dry rub, you know?
Yeah.
If you're slathering it with something that covers the original taste of the food or beverage, it seems like to me that you're kind of missing the point, but that's, you know, that's just me.
Exactly.
So tell us about how this beer was brewed.
So this is the third brewing advice I've done, and I've sort of stumbled on to what I like, what a process that works for me, and as Andy and I will talk about, there are a lot of other choices. What I do is I use a mash that's about 60% Pilsner malt and 40% wheat malt. Sometimes I'm a little higher than there, sometimes I'm a little lower. There's a little bit of confusion over what breweries in Berlin do currently. Some people say that all those breweries use more than 50% wheat malt. That's sort of the German Weiss beer thing, that to be called a wheat beer, it has to be more than 50% wheat. But then Brewing with Wheat says that Berliner Kindelweiss is one part wheat to three parts Pilsner. And there's certainly a historic precedent for using less than 50% wheat malt. So essentially, I just take this sort of regular, you know, pretty plain grist, no real, you know, other specialty malts, nothing like that. And I mash in at sort of mid-130s. Mid-130s, mid-120s, depending on you know, which beer it is. I'll leave it there for maybe half an hour or something like that. And during that time, I'll pull a decoction, nice, thick, mostly grain decoction, somewhere around one-third of the volume of the mash. Bring that up to a boil. Boil it for 5 or 10 minutes, 20 minutes, depending on the beer.
So you go you take the decoction straight from the mash temperature straight to boiling without any intermediary steps?
You know, I'm not sure if I've always done that. With a mash like this where you've got all the grains are pretty decently enzymatic, I don't think it's as big of a deal. I'll check my notes and see what I said here. I left it the protein rest for 5 minutes. And that's another thing, is the only time I add hops to this beer is into that first decoction. Very small amount of hops, somewhere between half an ounce and 1 ounce of Hallertau or Spalt or Crystal or anything sort of vaguely German.
So we're talking maybe 4% alpha acid, somewhere around there.
Exactly. And so in this one that we're drinking now, I brought it up to 155 and left it there for about 10 minutes to give it a little bit of time to convert. And then up to the boil, boiled it for 10 minutes, and then back into the mash. And the hope there is that you get a really low sacrification rest, something that'll play to beta amylase. So mid-140s, 144, 145, 146. This is a beer, as you were saying earlier, is very dry, very well attenuated. I mean, still, it doesn't taste thin, but it's a very small beer, and you know, still need to dry it out. And then after half an hour or so there, let's see, get back to my notes. Then I move it back up, do another decoction, or depending on the beer, just do a hot water infusion to bring it up to the mid to high 150s. And that just ensures that you've got good, you know, conversion. Because at 145, even after a half an hour, 45 minutes, the enzymes work a little bit slower. You may not get 100% of that starch broken down, and you really want this to be a beer that can completely ferment out. And then after that, sort of standard, you know, you can do a mash out if you want, or you can just, you know, start sparging with hot water. As a wheat beer, I mean, this is something that you might want to add rice hulls to. The runoff can be a little bit slow, just because it is a good chunk of huskless wheat.
Or you could do brew in a bag and not worry about the runoff at all.
Exactly. Just anything, I mean, and this will be dependent on your system. However you normally deal with the hefeweizen, and this would be the same thing. And then after that, I run off about the volume I want to have as my total batch volume. So I'd run off 5 gallons if I was doing a 5 gallon batch, maybe 5 1/4 gallons. Bring it up just barely to a simmer, maybe 210 degrees, and then chill it. No boil, nothing else. And then it makes for a really quick brew day. It can hurt your efficiency a little bit just because you're not sparging as much as you normally would. Mm-hmm. So you're not running as much water through. And then what I normally do is I'll pitch a healthy, active culture of lactobacillus. And one of the things with lactobacillus is it's very hop sensitive. I mean, that's one of the things we always hear: hops are preservative, hop, you know, prevents, you know, microbes from taking over. Lactobacillus is the primary microbe. It stops from taking things over. And particularly the commercial cultures from Y yeast and white labs are very hop sensitive. I think they're probably selected so that breweries could use them and then not have to worry so much about them getting into another beer. And so you want to make sure your IBUs stay maybe 4 IBUs, 5 IBUs, or even lower. And this is a beer. There's no hop character. There's no hop flavor. If you left the hops out, I don't think it would make any sort of, you know, have any sort of negative consequence.
Huh, that's interesting. So you wonder what kind of you're boiling that decoction, so you are getting some utilization out of there. So
yeah, I have actually no idea how much though, because you're boiling it along with the grain and for only about 10 minutes. I think ProMash says I have half an IBU in this beer, but I don't know how accurate that is.
So you bring it up to just right to a boil.
Yeah.
And then chill it and then pitch the lactobacillus. Do you do a starter with
this? Yes. For this beer, this was culture. This is White Labs lactobacillus. I use apple juice. People suggest different things. Apple juice is supposed to be good because it's very simple sugars. The lactobacillus that we're sold as homebrewers, as I was saying, doesn't deal with hops, also doesn't deal well with complex sugars. For example, we think of lactobacillus eating lactose, which is milk sugar. When you're making yogurt, lactobacillus is a big player, or buttermilk. Lactobacillus delbrueckii can't eat it. It pretty much only eats glucose. And so again, you want those simple sugars. It doesn't take very long to build it up. Lactobacillus can work very quickly, particularly if you hold the starter at an elevated temperature. Lactobacillus loves it up at 110, 115 degrees. Go much over 120, and either you're going to be putting it to sleep or really putting it to sleep. Get going. And then the recommendation, I was actually just kicking around an email with Kristen England, who's quoted extensively in Brewing with Wheat. And a lot of people have read that he suggests something like a 3-to-1 to a 5-to-1 bacteria to yeast population. And he's actually talking about the actual cell counts. And the yeast is about 1/10 the size of the bacteria is 1/10 the size of the yeast. So you actually really only need something like 40%. Oh, let's see what he said here. Yada, yada, yada. Something like half the volume of bacteria to yeast by volume. Just making sure it's healthy and actively fermenting, because once the yeast goes after those simple sugars first, after that, there really isn't much for the lactobacillus to work on.
So you haven't talked about yeast yet.
So a lot of people use German ale yeast, a Kolsch strain, an alt strain. I use USO5. I think it's more attenuative than pretty much any other clean ale strain. It does well with the acidity. It does well, all those things. And so I'm happy with it. Some people like English yeast, want a little fruitier. The other thing I do that not a lot of people do is I add some Brett or some Baldrigs from a sour beer. I like a little bit of funk, and this I wouldn't say is funky. I mean, tasting this would, I mean, it sort of, to me, it covers up some of the lactobacillus can have sort of a light vomity sort of aroma on its own. it's not real strong, yeah. and you might not notice it in a stronger, more flavorful beer, but sometimes it just tastes a little bit off to me. And that Brettanomyces will turn some of the lactic acid into esters combined with alcohol, make ethyl lactate, those sorts of things, which have a slightly fruity aroma that I think really sort of blends the beer together and mellows it out a bit.
Well, as this is warming, I am getting a little bit more of the kind of musty horse blanket, I guess, or the typical kind of Brett character. But it's not overpowering the sourness at all, and it's not, an in-your-face kind of funky character.
And part of that is that the beer dries out with that USO5 and the low mash temperature so far that there isn't much for the Brettanomyces to eat. Normally, when I'm making a sour beer, I'd mash, single infusion at 156, 158, something like that, just to leave a lot of those dextrins that the Brett over a year or whatever could chew on. And that's one of the great things about brewing a Berliner Weiss is that after 2 or 3 months, you're fine to bottle. Huh. At that point, the gravity, check your gravity, make sure it's stable. But at that point, it's pretty safe. And this has been, I think this is going on 7 or 8 months old at this point. So this is getting close to where I would say the peak would be. I mean, it'll certainly keep evolving and changing and whatnot. But I think it's drinking pretty well right now.
Yeah, it's wonderful. Now, do you pitch the yeast at the same time you pitch the lacto?
I do. I've played a little bit with pitching the lactobacillus first. The risk there, and this happened to a friend of mine, if you let the lactobacillus go too long and drop the pH too far, the yeast is not happy. It will start pumping out. It won't complete the fermentation, so it'll leave it sweet. It won't reabsorb the diacetyl. It will stop partway through and leave some acetaldehyde. It can cause problems. It can be done right. Like I did a goes and I did that. I pitched it just 12 hours in advance. And even after 12 hours, the lactobacillus had put up about a half inch of this sort of really airy, foamy head. And even then with the yeast, it was fine. It actually, surprisingly, didn't end up that sour.
Huh.
And so I that beer, I'd done something like 10 IBUs of hops, and I think that's part of what it was. I don't know the biology behind it because it seemed like the lactobacillus was happy and healthy, but it just didn't create the acid that I would that I'd expect.
Mm, that's delicious. Any other tips on this particular beer, this particular batch that you did?
No, I mean it's just one of those things that give it the right amount of time and make sure it dries out. I'm always surprised. Some people talk about getting a lot of lactic acid very quickly. It normally takes my beers 2 or 3 months to really get sour. And then at that point, this is probably about how it tasted when I bottled it, minus the carbonation.
Well, shall we move on to Andy's example, and then we can talk about kind of the history of that. Okay. Now, Andy, I think yours is a little more golden in color. The head dissipated more quickly, but it was
true.
It was white as well. Cheers.
Cheers. So this one has a little more of the, a little more funk in it, I think. I've got, so this one.
That's nice.
Basically the same, the recipe that Michael follows, was what I followed. Because obviously I consulted with him before I made my first batch.
This is nice. This is not as tart
as
Mike's, but it does have a little more of the funk, but it is also very refreshing.
Mm-hmm.
And it's I don't want to say clean because it's a little bit sour and a little bit funky, but it does. It is clean on the palate in that it doesn't stick around. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. It has sort of a freshness, sort of this grainy Pilsner-like. I really get more of that Pilsner malt character. Maybe a touch more sweetness than mine had, but still very dry and very carbonated.
Yeah, I like that a lot. So tell us about you got to work now. You can't just drink.
Yeah. Okay. So what I did is I started off with the same basic recipe design. As Michael did, I Same sort of split on the grain bill, 60-40. Then, like he did, I did the hops in the decoction, and I sparged it and collected 18.5 gallons. Collected that up into my electric kettle and held that at 180 for 20 minutes or so, and then chilled and I split it into two batches. I split off 5 gallons, and then I split off another 13.5 gallons. In one fermenter, the 5 gallon fermenter, and that's what we're drinking tonight. I added the Y yeast Berliner Weiss blend, which is German ale yeast, lactobacillus, and Brett strain. I'm not sure which strain. It was kind of an unusual brew in that at first it seemed normal. It took off, fermented at about, started it out about 70, and it took off and created about a half inch of Kreuzen. Pretty much what I expected from about a 3.2 beer. Didn't really expect much more than that. And then 2 days later, the thing erupted and came out the top of the carboy with kind of a creamy foam, kind of a thinner, much more creamy kind of mush that was coming out the airlock. So it was kind of surprising to me that it went from what seemed like, and it was obviously a transition between one and the other bug, I'm guessing. So at first, I'm guessing it was the German ale yeast taken off as it, you would expect. And then the lacto kicking in probably with the Brett finishing up at the very end. It did get a few little kind of specks on the surface at the very end, started to form a pellicle, but I bottled it right about that same time. So maybe I could have left it go a little longer. Maybe that would have developed a little more of the sourness, dried out a little more. I don't know. But the other, the 13.5 gallons, I just kegged that up yesterday, and it had USO5, a couple packs of USO5, and a big, about a 2 liter, starter of lacto from, White Labs. So I cranked that up as per your suggestion with the apple, juice. Nice, because it comes in a package. It's already sterile. You can just, no boiling, no real mess. Just bring it to room temperature and pitch the stuff in. I actually would then take that little starter of lacto and put it up on top of my stereo cabinets where it kind of kept it warm. And it would run through all the sugar, or it would do what I expected it to do, in 2 days. It would foam up and die back down and, it is much more tart. I've tried out. We have a little bit of the flat version. I haven't managed to get it carbonated yet, but it's surprising. It's got a lot of tartness, even more than this. So it's turned out pretty interesting. But it's a fun beer style to make. Some of the things that we had talked about the different ways people go about making this beer. Some people and places that make it use a sour mash method. Right. And they will actually pre-sour, they'll either sour their mash or they will, run sour off a wort and sour it. Some places will go ahead and do basically what we did. And at that point they will actually split it into two different vessels and sour one and ferment the other and then blend back to get a recipe. So there's, that was kind of what we spent a little while talking about, is how many different ways you could go about trying to make this beer, and is one better than the other? Maybe. I don't know. But
and this seems to be leaving out those sort of cheating methods of if you want to put a big chunk of acid malt, or if you want to dose with just pure lab grade, lactic acid, or
right. And I could see how somebody could, even a brewery could make a beer of this style, using techniques like a sour mash, and then be faced with the fact that it's not sour enough and they're going to have to dose it with something at the end to try to get it to back where they expect it to be. My feeling was that with the cultures, I might be able to develop a recipe that I could hit more often, whereas doing a sour mash beer, I would be afraid I wouldn't always be able to hit the same level of acidity each time.
So. Is there a way, if you do a sour mash, is there a way through measuring pH that you can kind of quantify how much sourness is in that sour mash before you get started?
Yeah, no, I mean, you certainly could. There is a method flowing around that I've played with, and there's actually just an article in the most recent Zymergy about making sour-worted beers using a starter built up from just grain and wort. And the idea with that, it's sort of a little bit more controllable way than a sour mash, is that by making this starter with grain, malt extract, whatever, holding it warm, you're favoring the lactobacillus. Once it pushes the pH down far enough, it's going to kill any sort of enteric bacteria or any, you know, E. coli, whatever else. And then you can take that starter and pitch it into the wort before the boil and give it 2 or 3 days. You can taste it every once in a while, get the acidity just where you want it, then boil. If you want to do a pH meter reading, or if you have pH strips that go down that low that are accurate, whatever. And it certainly would be a way that you could get a little bit more control and a little bit less funk. That's always my concern with the sour mash. I haven't done one, but from what I've heard, some people have great results and some people end up with dirty diapers in the summertime or whatever. And even when you have to boil it for 2 hours to try to, you know, knock all that out. And a beer like this that's so light and crisp and clean, other than the sourness, even just a little bit of that is gonna really throw it off.
Yeah, we went to Upright Brewing in Portland, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they do a beer with a sour mash, and they essentially just take a cooler, a rectangular picnic cooler, and fill it with mash or with grain and hot water, leave it overnight, and the next day it's funky as all get out.
Yeah.
But you know, I don't know how much of that is sourness and how much of that is, as you say, is funkiness.
Yeah. It's not necessarily the good sort of funkiness, because it's not Brett working at those temps and times.
Mm.
It's something else.
Right. Now, let me ask you an off-the-wall question, and you guys can bring us back on track after this. But I'm doing a sauerkraut. I went to your site, among others, but yours was a primary example because it was more scientific in the way, you know, you'll be seeing it on Basic Brewing Video, and I'm going to give you a mention on there, but
sure.
You were more measured in the way that you added salt to the cabbage to make sauerkraut. Anyway, you know, I'm getting a decent level of sourness on my sauerkraut. It's been in there for about 3 weeks. I assume that's lactobacillus that's working in there.
You know, I don't actually think it is.
Really?
I think sauerkraut, I'm trying to remember now. Let's see, sour.
I've seen it referenced in some, you know, some videos through YouTube and some articles, but we all know how accurate the internet is all the time.
Speaking of the internet, Wikipedia says lactobacillus and actually pediococcus are part of it, but is Leuconostoc is the primary bacteria.
Really?
And so, you know, I don't know what the story with that bug is.
I was just wondering if you could pull a sample of the sauerkraut juice off and use that in a starter or put it in some apple juice, and I wonder what would happen.
You could certainly give it a shot. You know, I haven't tried. I know some people will use, you know, the whey from yogurt, or will use various other lactobacillus sources. I did a beer that I forget if you ever had with sourdough starter, and you know that has lactobacillus in it too. And there are a lot of these options that it's probably going to be very dependent on what sort of bacteria you happen to have from your cabbage and your, you know, water on your sauerkraut.
Well, I think, you know, we can easily segue this into something that really would make sense, especially for this style of beer. And that is, just like you're saying, the truth is the sourdough culture has wild yeast and it has lacto in it. And sometimes it has very high-performing lacto.
Yeah.
So this has definitely crossed my mind, is to take maybe actually order a brand new fresh culture and maybe try to do a starter culture for this beer with like the San Francisco culture and see if you couldn't. Because, I mean, the truth is you wouldn't need that much yeast to get, you know, it would probably be enough of both to do the job.
You know, surprisingly, and that's essentially exactly what I did. I got a sourdough culture from Fermented Treasures. I took some of it and mixed it with water and flour and made a bread. Sorry, I mixed some with a weak wort starter. And went into one of my kvasses, and it was a beer that had very few IBUs, and it just never really soured much. It had sort of this nice bready character. And I was down to my last bottle, and we went to visit East End Brewing last summer, who helped Scott the brewer had helped me with the recipe. He's sort of one of the guys who started kvass back up, as we talked about on that interview. And when we cracked open that bottle, he cracked open that bottle. Explosion just all over the place, all over him. He was very gracious. He tried it. He thought it was still pretty, you know, drinkable or whatever, but it must have been some wild yeast that was in the sourdough culture that had taken. I mean, because I'd had bottles maybe, that was at 2 years, maybe at 18 months I'd had one, and it wasn't overcarbonated. And maybe it was staying warm in the brewery, or that we'd just driven it over there, or who knows what other combination of things, but clearly something had gone on.
It's just your poor sanitation practices, Mike. Yeah.
But that actually brings up something else that what we did on some of those kvasses to get them sour was just to use packaged bread yeast. I think that's something, if you kept the IBUs on this very low, those bread yeast are not packaged in the same sanitary manner that Saffale or Lallemand or whoever makes the brewer's yeast. And that's actually something you can do. And particularly in a beer that's low alcohol, the bread yeast isn't going to have alcohol tolerance issues. And that would be an option if you didn't have a good yeast and or lactobacillus culture.
A little more head this time.
Yeah, I wonder...
We're a little more aggressive.
It's a beautiful beer. I wonder if some of your head retention went out the top of the carboy. Would that happen? I mean, would some of the protein?
No, the problem with the Berliner Weiss, and this is going to be, and this is in the style guideline, is that the head dissipates quickly because of the acidity of the beer. So
this,
it's difficult.
This one is hanging around like Mike's did.
Yeah, Mike's is doing the same.
I mean, I think part of it is, I mean, the carbonation is really sort of, you know, like swirling and powerful. I mean, mine was very carbonated. This is probably up near that 4 volumes of CO2.
But
here's also the first pour anyway was crystal clear. This one has a little bit of haze to it from the yeast on the bottom.
Yeah, but, I found that in this one, no matter how long I had it sitting, there was still about a quarter inch kind of wisp. And I'm guessing that's that powdery, very small lacto that isn't, it's not as easy for it to settle down and pack down like that. So I think that gets kicked up pretty easily after one or two pours.
Yeah.
And Andy, you've been playing with tossing or putting different worts on top of dregs of different beers. And you've been, this is in this series of these beers, right? I mean, you've been kind of playing around with... you know, the dregs from one or the this from the other, and kind of making sort of hybrid beers along the way. And that's another thing that you can do.
Right. Yeah. And I've been having a lot of fun with that. You know, I did a lot of kegging, and I kind of have flipped back and started to look into doing some bottling, and we'll split between kegging some and taking what's left. And, you know, if you can accurately measure how much you have in your bottling bucket, you can accurately compute how much, you know, sugar to add for any priming level you want. Mix it up. And then one of the things that I've really enjoyed doing is that, like, in the last, I'll leave like the last 6 bottles, you know, in the bottom of the bottling bucket. And then I'll go get the low fill from the last time I did a Brett beer and dump that in there. We've all talked about doing the, taking like Orval and doing the dregs, but you really don't even have to go to that much trouble sometimes, you know. Especially on something like this, you know, split a bottle of Jolly Pumpkin with a friend and swirl up the bottom of that and pitch it in the last 6 bottles of your bottling bucket. And now you have a kind of a variant on that beer that's going to be a little unique and pretty rare.
Yeah.
As long as you don't have a lot of residual sugars left over in that beer, you don't want to blow things up.
or if you do, be very mindful and open one every week or so, and if it starts getting too carbonated, put it in the refrigerator. The bugs will keep working at that temperature, and you'll still have to drink them pretty soon, but it'll slow them down at least.
So what's up next? I mean, what have you guys not done to this style that you want to try next?
Dry hopping.
Yeah. Wow. I mean, it'd be a little scary, you would think, to dry hop and for the your poor little lacto friends.
Well, no. So that would be the idea, is that you'd wait until you got as much acidity as you wanted, and you could dry hop. And to me, that bright lemony acidity with some American hops, you know, that orange or that grapefruit or whatever, would be delicious. I've done a couple of dry hops, sort of like you were talking, six bottles from a Flanders Red and just throwing some hop cones into each bottle. And that's really worked well, the sour reds with, you know, Citra or with Centennial or Cascade or whatever. And so Berliner Weiss, I think, is a really sort of natural pairing with that, you know, American hop character.
Or is it the Sriracha Ace that is said to have a very lemony character?
Yeah.
It seems like that would be a nice pair.
So, and let's see, the last thing I tried in this strain was a little Imperial Berliner Weiss. I did that around New Year's Eve, and that was only because I had this carboy with this first one, and I had just bottled it, so I swirled the dregs up from that and pitched it into an Imperial Berliner Weiss, all of 6.5% by volume.
I actually did something similar. The beer we drank was actually only about half of that batch. I actually made it to about 10:45 and then watered 3 gallons down to 10:32. And then the rest of it's still sitting downstairs in my basement with lacto, the USO5, and then whatever dregs I've tossed into there over the last 6 months or so.
Hmm. Well, this is definitely a style that when we first started brewing, even just a handful of years ago, if someone had told us that they made a beer like this, we would probably tell them that it wouldn't work. You know, you do all this stuff to your beer. You don't boil it. You don't put the hops in, you know, into the kettle. You throw a bunch of bugs in there. It's something that was beyond our level of understanding, especially when we first started brewing. I mean, the rules were hard and fast back then. There were certain things that you had to do. You had to boil for an hour. You had to, they're just very certain, these rules that you did not break. But this breaks a lot of rules in, you know, traditional, quote-unquote, brewing.
And particularly, I mean, this is the sort of thing that I think most people would say, well, why isn't there DMS? I mean, Pilsner malt, no boil. I mean, a lot of people advocate even a 60-minute boil isn't enough. That a 90-minute boil is really, and a vigorous boil and a quick cool. And this is one of those beers that I'm not sure if it's that the fermentation is violent enough that it blows off that DMS that a lager yeast wouldn't, or if it's that, in fact, I mean, I think a lot of DMS is formed at the boil, and you're also driving off in this one where you're keeping it below there. Maybe you're not forming as much as you would, and we still have the SMM, the precursor, but not the DMS itself, which is what tastes like rotten cabbage or whatever.
Yeah, there's no canned corn in this at all.
Mm.
And like you said, the Pilsner malt, the Pilsner style is. I can't hear you. I can't hear myself think of the foaming of Andy's beer over there. He's showing off the the head has come back. I don't know where it went. But anyway, yeah, the Pilsner malt, the Pilsner style, you're right. They recommend 90-minute boil to drive off those DMS precursors and the you know, you don't cover the thing when you're chilling because you want to keep the all that, and this again breaks those rules. But you know, it would be interesting to see where, you know, to do some side by side testing to find out where those corny flavors come from, whether they are created in the boil or wherever they, or whether it's a, you know, if you did a lager, somehow a lager Berliner Weiss. Of course, I guess the bugs wouldn't, the souring bugs wouldn't like that very much, the colder temperature. Andy is pouring a bonus beer that I'm afraid you don't have, Mike. I'm sorry. But which is this one, Andy?
This is the beer I kegged yesterday. This is the Berliner Weiss with the USO5 and just the lacto, but it's not carbonated yet.
Hmm. Yeah, it's flat, but I'm getting there's like a almost a cinnamon kind of a. Hmm. Mm. You taste that? There's
a little bit.
There's a spicy kind of. Ooh, that's nice.
Mm. I think it'll be better when it's all fizzy.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, you can tell the carbonation does bring a bit to the table there. Well, guys, this has been fun. Again. And I think that this is probably a beer that that I'll try this summer. I'd like to try my hand at a sour mash and see how it goes. Mm. So maybe we will be back for another chapter of the Berliner Weiss discussion.
It's a lot of fun, guys. Thanks for having me, as always.
Yeah, thanks, Mike. And thanks, Andy.
No problem. Anytime.
Very nice. All three of those beers were very, very nice. That's a style that I would love to do, because in the summertime, you know, big, heavy beers are not always appropriate. It'd be nice to have, it would especially be nice to have a nice, tart little beer with low hop presence that would have less of a risk of being skunked out in the summertime sun. So I want to try that. Thanks again to Andy and Mike Tonsmeyer. You can find Andy Sparks's shop at thehomebrewery.com. And Michael Tonsmeyer's blog is at themadfermentationist.com. Worth a read. Remember, a while back I tasted a Berliner Weiss that the guys in Oklahoma brewed when I went over there for the Stein beer episode. And those guys did a sour mash and had a great success. So don't discount a sour mash altogether. And you may want to re-listen to that episode from the archives before you brew your own version of the Berliner Weiss. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com. And please don't forget to tell us where you're from. You can find our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits on our website, along with our 2011 Brewer's Logbook. And we've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can find our shirts in the store, too. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online from us in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com associate link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products this week that were purchased through the link are Rule Your Freakin' Retirement, How to Retire Rich by Actively Managing Your Assets, and English Village Pubs. Thanks again, everybody. And remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site the next time you feel like Amazon shopping, and we appreciate your support. And don't forget that you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to BYO Magazine through our associate links on basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer, production help for Basic Brewing Radio, and our website is provided by Kelly Dotson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.